Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to introduce yet another guest that I met at the Aero Conference. The owner of Buggy Road Farm, where they actually sell microgreens, and it's a micro farm specializing in duck eggs, asparagus, plant starts, and microgreens. And they're growing these very close to me, actually. They are in Whitefish, Montana, which is just about 45 miles south of where I live. They use growing methods that are in line with their ethics. So no chemical sprays, pesticides, herbicides, GMOs, antibiotics, hormones, or cages, which I like that part. Maybe we'll get into that discussion a little today. So I'm very excited to introduce Sarah Harding, who was so fun to talk to at the Aero Conference and just meet and to learn a little more about you. So welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. Flattering. I'm excited to be here.
Cool. Well, go ahead and tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a mother of two children, age 6 and 10, happily married. My husband and I bought this land about 11 years ago and built a house, and we've been adding on pretty much ever since. We didn't start out, we're first-generation farmers, so we didn't start out farming the land. I was just an avid gardener, and John financed my hobby for the first 6 or 8 years until I kind of made that shift from gardener to farmer. And now we both farm full-time here.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm excited to learn that, because that's kind of where we're in the stage of shifting to trying to see if we can come up with enough food to grow a CSA, or even just to sell at the farmer's market, or, you know, that's kind of our story. So we've been working on it for a lot longer, but we're still not anywhere near making money or anything yet. So
yeah, that's the hard part.
It seems like, I just thought, like, so our big struggle, we haven't really had a well and or enough water, like, to barely grow enough for us. And then we finally dug a deep well the year before last, and this is really the first year that we planted. And so Mike built like this mini farm, and I thought it was going to produce just a ton of food. And I mean, it certainly produced a lot of food. It definitely produced enough food for us. But as far as like producing enough for like 10 CSA shares, forget like 50 or 100. I can't even imagine like what that's going to take and how we're going to scale it and make that leap. But maybe, you know, it's just a matter of learning and getting it. So yeah, the money part is definitely. But so now you guys, I'm excited to hear about the growing microgreens in Whitefish.
Yeah, we grow.
And how you're doing that.
Yeah, we grow them year round. So we built a greenhouse on the south side of a shop that John built, and it's insulated, and we got a bunch of sliding glass doors off of Craigslist. So there's six sets of sliding glass doors in there. And then it has like a polycarbonate roof and a gravel floor, and we start the microgreens twice a week, and then we move them out the greenhouse and grow them for about 2 weeks, and then we harvest them twice a week. And that's the microgreens pretty much pay the bills.
Really?
Yeah, the duck eggs is, we love having animals and we like ducks, and their eggs people really value. A lot of people that are allergic to chicken eggs can still have duck eggs, so the people that want duck eggs, they really want duck eggs. But we don't make a ton of money. I think we break even on them. And that's not including our time, which farmers can almost never count.
So just, like, it pays for the food, though, and to have the ducks?
Yeah, it pays.
So how many ducks do you have?
We keep up to 40. Right now, wow. We just finished butchering some old ducks, so we only have 15, but we have 15 more arriving in 2 weeks. Wow. And then we'll raise them through the winter, and then hopefully they'll start laying in the spring.
So are they baby ducks that you're getting, yeah, or where do you get ducks from?
Well, the big hatcheries, they hatch chicks and ducks, and they pop them immediately into the male, and they arrive here 2 days later, because the day old...
They come in the mail?
Yes, they come...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the post office calls us at like 5 in the morning, and we drive down there and pick them up.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, and you can hear the box.
So where are they coming from?
Oh, there's quite a few hatcheries. They, or chicks, when they're born, still have enough of the yolk that they've absorbed in their system to be able to survive without food or water for a day or two or up to three. Three is kind of pushing it. So...
Wow.
As long as they get food and water right away, then they pretty much thrive straight out of the mailbox.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been thinking about getting a duck because I had this girl from Billings, Amelia Schmitz, talked about they got some chickens and a baby duck. And she said, it just sounded so cute. And just the way she talks about the duck following her around and it gets along with the chickens, it thinks it's a chicken. And I was like, oh, we might have to try a duck. So we're down to just 3 chickens right now. And then we just got the sheep.
Oh, fun.
We have 4 sheep now. Like, we've had them for a week.
Wow. Very new.
A new, very, very new experience for me. I've never had any kind of animals like that. I've had a hard enough time with the chickens for 10 years being in a pen. And now the sheep are kind of a new experience. But they all have a pretty... And now our chickens just get out. They have completely free roam. They have figured out how to get in and out of their pen at all times. So the sheep is going to be, we'll see. So yeah, so exciting. All right. So ducks coming in the mail. You're getting 15 new ducks.
Yeah, I think 15.
And you sell duck eggs, yeah. And then you have the microgreens, yeah, which are paying the bills, which is cool to hear. And so I was reading, I think, in that new article in Flathead Living that you sell a lot of the microgreens to restaurants.
We do. We sell them to high-end restaurants. And then we also kind of wanted it to get out to just everyone. So we sell them in green 3-ounce packages to grocery stores. So the local health food stores and even a major chain store here in Whitefish sells our microgreens. And
I would think that would go pretty good in Whitefish.
Yeah, we have a pretty good following. We're super lucky to have a really supportive community that's in love with microgreens.
Okay, so in case some people are wondering, do you want to tell everybody what a microgreen is?
Oh yeah, good point.
Because I wouldn't even actually know if I hadn't just read it,
right,
a few minutes ago.
So a lot of people call our microgreens sprouts because they're pretty similar to sprouts, but there's a few key differences. So sprouts, most of your listeners have probably sprouted things in a jar. And you rinse it, and when you eat them, you eat the root and the stem and the pretty pale, underdeveloped leaves. So that's a sprout. And what we grow is we have trays of organic potting soil, and we seed them, and they grow for 2 weeks in the soil, and then we harvest them with scissors. So you're not actually eating the root, and they're grown just like baby lettuce would be grown out in the field, and you're harvesting them, and then we mix them. We have a vitality mix that has a lot of brassicas in it, like cabbage and kale and kohlrabi and broccoli and pak choi, and then we put some pea shoots on top. And then we have a spicy mix, the exhilarating mix, which is a couple different kinds of radishes, couple different kinds of mustards, and arugula. And so the microgreens are really, the chefs really love them because they're tiny, but they're perfect and beautiful, and they have flavor and color, and they're just really vibrant. And they use them a lot of times to garnish their plates. And then our retail customers, they just love them on sandwiches, and salads, and I mean, our family puts them on everything. Spaghetti, chili. But nice. Yeah. So that's
And I was thinking there was that beautiful picture on your Facebook page of a salad that you had made for, I think, a wedding.
Yeah, that was one of my husband's friends. Yeah.
All right. So how'd you end up with microgreens? Like, where'd you learn about that? Or how'd you decide to go? Okay, wait, before I do that, let me just make sure like listeners understand. So when you say, and maybe they got to this point, but when you were first talking, I was thinking the vitality mix was something you were putting in the soil, but the vitality mix with the brassicas, that means those are the sprouts, like broccoli sprouts and kale.
We grow a flat of kale and a flat of broccoli, and then we harvest them and mix them together into our vitality mix.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then how did you get into, you know, choosing microgreens, or where'd you learn about how to grow them? And
I know people ask me that question all the time, and the answer is I really don't totally remember when I first heard about them. But here at the community college in Kalispell, a lovely man, Bill McLaren, I believe is his name. Hopefully my memory is right.
Anyway, okay, Bill McLaren at the community college.
Yeah, so Bill McLaren offered a class at our Flathead Valley Community College about microgreens. And I believe it was just one session. And in it, he taught us all about microgreens and how to plant them and gave us seeds and soil and trays. And in it, he mentioned his granddaughter is a farmer in Bozeman, and she grew and sell 200 flats of microgreens a week down in Bozeman. And it was something that I had already been thinking about that would be something good for us. And then when he said that, it was like getting struck by lightning. Like, oh my gosh, that's what we're going to do. So,
awesome.
Yeah. That was the plan. And I came home from that, and we started growing a whole bunch and built the greenhouse, and hopefully we can keep going with it for a while.
Oh, I think it's just going to expand. I think you're going to do really well. It sounds great. And I think more restaurants are going to be excited to hear about the options. And I think people will like them the more that they see them. If they would carry them in the regular stores, would help too. Because sprouts are so healthy for you, or microgreens.
Yeah.
But just fresh, that it's super fresh. I mean, I guess basically it's kind of like sprouts, but you're cutting the roots off. Is that the big difference? And you're letting them grow a little longer?
Yep, they're grown a little longer. Sorry. And they're grown with sunlight. So the plant's actually photosynthesizing instead of the sprout just being grown in water, kind of on your kitchen counter, or, you know, the leaves aren't green and developed. Mm-hmm. And so, and it also doesn't have as high of risk of foodborne illness, because it's not the potential for bacteria to grow in the watery, tightly packed environment.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. All right, so you know what? I never did even ask you about your very first gardening experience, which is usually how I do open the show, is asking, you know, like, who were you with? Were you a kid, an adult? You know, how old were you? What'd you grow? What was your very first gardening memory?
Well, my dad loved gardening, and so that was farther back than I can really clearly remember. We had a garden, and I grew up in San Diego, so it was a Southern California garden with avocados and artichokes and, you know, all sorts of lovely, warm things. So, yeah, that's helping my dad, I'm sure. He was a high school teacher, and so in the summer times, he would take on landscaping jobs for other people. Yep. And, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to tell us what, like, organic gardening or friendly gardening means to you?
Well, I think that it's not super complicated. It's just having respect for the water and the soil and the life in the soil. on the life on top of the soil and the air, and just not doing anything, doing no harm, basically. And so it takes a lot of thought, and it takes a lot of care, and you really have to be careful with what you bring in, because there is so many pollutants from chemicals and petrochemicals that are in the materials that potentially you could bring onto your farm or garden. So, like, I'm thinking about, like, manure or straw or hay or feed or even topsoil. You know, you really have to ask a lot of questions and know which questions to ask to make sure that you're not unintentionally polluting your little piece of land that you've been given the honor of being the steward of.
Oh, I like the way you put that. Do you have any suggestions for, like, questions listeners should think to ask, like anything in particular? If you don't, that's fine, but if you have something, maybe that...
Well, for us, knowing our fellow farmers is really important. So, like, we know the people that raised the hay that we buy for our rabbits and our ducks and chickens. And so we know that it hasn't been sprayed. We know that it's that they're doing a fantastic job taking care of their soil. And the same with the straw. We bought it from a fellow Aero member.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so we know that it's organic, and that straw especially is tricky because here in the Flathead Valley, a lot of farmers spray with a persistent herbicide that lasts for up to 7 years. And it passes unchanged through animals' digestive systems. So if the animal, say you're friend has a horse and she feeds her horse hay, and we don't know where that hay came from. The horse eats the hay has been sprayed with this chemical, and I believe a lot of times it goes under the name Millennium, but it probably has 15 different trade names that it goes under. So that chemical passes unchanged through the horse and is now in its manure, and so anything you put that manure on has now those chemicals in it. And so, like, you couldn't grow peas in that because they would just be shriveled and stunted and potentially not even sprout if there was enough of it in there. And it affects tomatoes. I mean, it affects all broad-leaved plants besides the grasses that they are looking for when they're growing hay. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated.
One of my very first guests.
That was a long answer.
Peggy Jane Owsley was the first one to really talk about that. And she said the big thing is that you have to make sure that it's not weed-free hay, which to me, I always think weed-free, I'm thinking chemical-free, but it's really the opposite. She said if it is weed-free, then it means it does have the chemical sprayed on. That's what you have to watch out for. And so it's taken me this whole 8 months to wrap my head around that, but I think I finally have it straight now.
Yeah, that's definitely a red flag.
And yeah, that's what she said. A lot of, because she worked in a nursery up here for, I don't know, 10, 20 years, for a long time. And so she, you know, would interact with the different gardeners and people around. And so she heard a lot of things about people really struggling to find manure that they could put on their gardens up here, and that people were having problems with things weren't growing.
Right.
So yeah, it's important. And that's part of that. I mean, that's the biggest reason people are like, why'd you guys get sheep? And because we want the manure, we want to have something to put. If we're going to try to expand our garden, we need to have manure to put on there. And so we debated back and forth a lot between sheep and goats. And so we just ended up deciding on trying the sheep for now because we figured they had wool.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, goats make milk, so either way, I suppose. But I don't know, we just, that's what we went with, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
But that's really the biggest reason. That's why we've had chickens all along. I mean, the eggs to me are the bonus, but it's really for the manures why we've had chickens for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Finding fresh fertilizer for your garden is a tough one sometimes.
Right, and we pay a lot of attention to the microbial life in our soil. Doing things like composting, even like we call it our vegan compost, because we don't put any animal products in there, just on the off chance that potentially it could have been contaminated. So it's like our weeds and leaves and brewer's mash and chaff from our local coffee roaster and coffee grounds and all those things are the food for, or actually the introducing these microorganisms. And then we also do a lot of compost tea. So we take the worm castings from our worm bins and put it in a 5-gallon bucket in a little cheesecloth with water and a fish tank aerator, and we make this tea that we can spray, and that introduces a lot of the good microbial life into the soil. And the theory is that if you have enough of the right fungus and microbial life and bacteria, that you really don't need a lot of fertilizer except for the humus that it introduces.
Oh, okay. Cool. Mike makes some kind of compost tea with the chicken manure a lot, that he'll wrap it up in the cheesecloth and then put it in a bucket of water and let it kind of soak in there for a while.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know
stuff.
How he stands it. When he takes the lid off that bucket, I'm just like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's really important to aerate it though, so that you encourage the good bacteria and not the let the bad grow.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask him about that. So you put a fish tank aerator in the bucket.
Yeah, one of those little bubblers, and we just tied a washer to it. So one of those, it has like a little porous stone on the end. We just weigh it down with a washer so that it bubbles from the bottom up.
Okay, cool. So who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Have you always been that way, or was there something that changed? Or
I've always been pretty crunchy. I think starting in high school, I spent a lot of time at my best friend's house, and they were what most people would call hippies. And so we... You know, they had a big garden, and we cooked a lot, and we did batiking, and, you know, all that good stuff. And I started learning from them, and just kind of was always attracted to the natural, healthy way. Mm-hmm. And then here in Whitefish, I'd say Pam Gurwee of Purple Frog taught me more than any other one person about the actual way in which you go about being natural.
Cool. All right. Well, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Well, we're pretty excited our asparagus is doing well. We planted...
It disconnected us. Cool. All right. I'm excited to hear about your asparagus.
Yeah.
Because somebody was just asking me about how to grow asparagus, if you grew them from seed or if you do it from starts or what to do. And then they take a while to get going, right?
Yeah. So we planted 1-year-old crowns 2 years ago. And so this coming spring will be our first real harvest. We harvested a tiny bit last year, which was super exciting and kind of like wet our taste for fresh asparagus, but we planted a 1/4 acre, so we're really hoping that we'll get a lot of asparagus this spring. But it's
all right.
It's growing really well.
You sell every single stem you get.
Yeah, we have 5 or 6 different varieties, and I'd say the purple asparagus is definitely the most beautiful. It's pretty striking.
I didn't even know they came in different strains. So where did you get, what did you call them, crowns?
Yeah, the crowns. So basically another farmer plants seeds and grows them for a year and then pulls up the crowns in their, I'm imagining, beautiful sandy soil. And then they box them up and sell them to us. And so we're buying 1-year-old crowns, which is nice because we get a 1-year head start. And the success rate seems a little higher than the ones that I planted from seed. Like pretty much all of our crowns sprouted and are doing wonderfully.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
And so then next spring you'll have them.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So we planted quite a few crowns. So we're hoping for a couple hundred pounds of asparagus over an 8-week period.
So now, did you plant them like spread out like over 8 weeks so that they're going to come up over 8 weeks? You're just going to harvest them different, or like how's that going to work?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. So we planted them. No, we planted them all at the same time, and they're in rows. They're in double rows. You just dig a trench and then you plant them, you know, whatever the prescribed amount is, 8 inches or whatever. And then right now they look like a mini forest of fronds, tall, ferny fronds that are probably, most of them are probably 6 feet tall.
Wow,
so we'll mow
really?
All that down, and then in the early spring, you know, the earth is just waking up, so like May, the spears will push up from the crown out of the earth, and we wait till they grow about 6 inches tall, and then we'll harvest them. And we keep harvesting them. We cut off every spear that comes up out of the ground for 8 weeks. And then after that, we let them all grow up into ferns to feed the roots for next year.
Okay, cool. We have like, I think 6 asparagus or something like growing. I don't remember where we got them from that we started. I think we just bought a few at the nursery or something, and they never really did very well. But when they come up, they don't even make it 2 feet. I mean, I eat them just
yeah.
right away. They're so tender and fresh, and just there's nothing like asparagus that grow in your garden. You won't even think of cooking them. They're just delicious.
Yeah, they're so delicious raw.
I think you will do. Mm-hmm. I think you'll do super with those. And even though there are some wild asparagus around here in Montana, I think overwhelmingly we have a major shortage. And when they come up right around, I always think of them around Easter time, you know, in the stores. I mean, there's nothing, I don't think you'll have any problem, I think, to compare it with ones that you're going to grow fresh.
Yeah, we...
And I'll bet the restaurants really love them, too.
They do. Yeah, we did a little bit of research before we decided to invest all that time and money into asparagus. And the other farmers that we talked to that grow asparagus said, we sell every single stick we can grow. The hardest part is keeping it weeded, because asparagus do not compete well with weeds, especially perennial weeds such as like quackgrass or... You know, you've got to keep all that out of your asparagus patch. So, and that has been totally true for us. We can sell every stick we've grown so far, and the weeds are really the difficult part. Because
so how do you deal with them?
We spend so many hours just hand weeding. Early on, when the weeds are tiny, we use a stirrup hoe to kind of just knock off the babies under the surface of the soil. And then we also did a path of a layer of cardboard and then wood chips in our paths to try to smother at least that portion of weeds, and then just hand pulling over and over.
That's a lot of hand pulling a quarter of an acre. But it's going to be worth it. I think you're going to like those.
Yeah, we're excited about it.
We were talking about your excitement over the asparagus.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really good. I think it's going to be a ton of hard work. It's going to be super intense because we're going to be harvesting, you know, every single day for 8 weeks. And it's... a whole farm season's worth of harvesting into 8 weeks, you know, so all that marketing and delivery and packaging is just condensed into this really short window. But hopefully it'll pay off and be worth it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited for you guys. I hope it works out for you. I think it will. I think you have some good karma on your side.
Thank you.
It'll be a good thing. So... All right. How about something you're excited? Well, that is that something you're excited to try different next year, or is there something else that's going to be new? Or
well, we didn't even finish this season before I was already excited for next season. But we are going to expand our edible flower selection next year. That was something that we just kind of did a tiny bit of, and the response was fantastic. It just seems like the customers that really like microgreens also really like edible flowers. So that's something that we're going to do a lot more of. And then also our cut flowers.
So what kind of flowers?
So this year we just did violas and nasturtiums and lemon gem marigolds and bachelor's buttons and calendula. But next year we're going to try
a whole list. Sounds like a lot.
Yeah. Wow. There's actually quite a few more ones. I'm learning new ones all the time that we're going to be trying and sampling as far as taste. The thing that I liked about most of those, except for the calendula, was that they tasted delicious. You know, the nasturtiums are sweet and peppery and beautiful, and the lemon gem marigolds actually do have like a very lemony aftertaste, and the violas are almost like pepperminty and really delicate and delicious. So we're excited to see what else we can grow and sell for edible flowers. And then also our cut flowers. We're going to really expand our selection of cut flowers. But I don't think that our customers will really see much of that, because hopefully we're going to sell most of those wholesale.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I really like selling directly to the florists and letting them fuss over making the bouquets perfect and fantastic and gorgeous. I really just like growing them and enjoying that.
That's interesting. Okay,
that
cool.
Part of it.
I thought about being a flower florist for a while. And actually, I planted 750 sunflowers this year to kind of see if I could, you know, cut them and get them ready and take them to the florist and be consistent. And I completely flopped. For one thing, I realized 750 sunflowers is nothing.
Really?
I need to be like more like 700 a week, I think, for 6 weeks or something, or 1,000 a week, or yeah, a lot more. It wasn't anywhere near enough to, you know, I could have brought like a few bouquets into my house every 3 or 4 days, but as far as, I don't think so. It didn't seem like it. I actually ended up like not cutting any. We decided that I was just going to save them for the bird seed, and then the birds ate most of that too.
Yeah, that's great.
So I got a lot of pictures that I can paint is about what my flower thing came down to. But
gorgeous. That's a lot of sunflowers.
It was beautiful. But they ended up like, I don't know, it was weird. Like even though I planted them, like I planted the first batch on like the week of Earth Day. And then the next batch I didn't plant till like the middle of May. And then the last ones I put in the first week of June.
Mm-hmm.
But they still all seem to bloom practically at the same time. Actually, the only ones that bloom latest were the first ones, which were the Martha Stewart Organics. And they just were huge. They grew to like be like 12 feet tall. And they had the huge, giant heads. The ones that were probably the most likely to pick were the... my husband was like, why don't you just plant the bird seed sunflowers? So he's like, why did you bring home all these packets? This is expensive. Why didn't you just grab a handful of the bird seed? So 350 of them were the bird seed. And those were, but then they didn't last in the vases.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another thing I found out from talking to this woman who sells tons of cut flowers. She's like, the pro cut flowers. So this is where I learned variety really counts. So she said that that's what they've learned. And that's what she plants is 1,000 a week.
Now, oh my gosh.
She's like in Williamsburg, Virginia, and probably sells a lot more. I mean, she cuts 10,000 stems a week.
Wow.
During the season at her little quarter acre farm. She just is a massive flower farmer. Her name's Lisa Ziegler, and I've had her on twice.
That's so great.
And she, she, But that, yeah, when she said she plants 1,000 sunflowers a week, I was like, oh, okay. So 750, that's part of my problem too, was it still just wasn't anywhere near enough.
Yeah.
And then there were some that were really pretty, have really dark black centers, mm-hmm. That were like some burpee seeds that I got, and they were really pretty, but just, you know, they came with like 25 seeds in a pack, and there just wasn't very many.
Oh yeah, they're pretty expensive. Those good varieties.
Yeah.
We've noticed that same thing with our tomatoes. That if we plant them when other people are planting them really early, or we can wait until like March or April, and the ones we planted really early kind of just hang out and don't really grow, and the ones we plant later catch up to them and pass them. You know, kind of the same as your sunflowers. It planting them earlier, I think it has to do with our cold and our length of our days. Planting them later doesn't seem to, it seems to actually, well, it's better for us because we don't have to take care of them for those extra 2 months. and it seems to be a little better for the plants. They just have a little more vigor to jump out of the ground and grow quickly.
Because see, what I decided was that I should have planted them all that first week in April. Like I thought I should have planted them all around Earth Day. Like I thought that the other ones I planted in May, and because then I didn't have any sunflowers. Like everything came on like the middle of August.
Yeah. Sunflowers are real cold hardy.
I had sunflowers.
So that would probably work.
So yeah, well, maybe.
I don't know. You guys are kind of in the banana belt, aren't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They call it tropical Montana up here sometimes.
It could still snow here in April.
And it's weird because like even like, oh yeah, yeah. But they're, sunflowers are, that's what my husband was worried about. But I was like, no, they're like spinach. They'll grow. They're pretty hardy. If you get them in the dirt, you know, and then you get a storm, they're not going to die like some other fragile things.
Yeah, it's true.
But yeah, it's weird. Like even Eureka has 3 weeks on us because we're just south of town. And their stuff all comes into bloom 3 weeks ahead of us.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And then I have other friends that are like in Trigo that are 3 weeks behind us yet. And as you go on down the line.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. I don't know. All right. Well, how about tell us about something that didn't work so well this season?
Oh, my gosh. There's always failures. I try to just block those out and move on. Okay. Let's see. What did not do well? Well, a lot of times that happens pretty early on with our seed starting. You know, they'll be just like, okay. I'm thinking of like the cut flowers. You know, they'll be like a flat that just kind of fails to thrive. It's not getting the conditions that it needs. It's not warm enough, or it's not sunny enough, or bad seed or whatever. So we didn't have as many varieties of cut flowers as we'd hoped.
Okay. I like that. That's encouraging to listeners that, you know, the failures are just not that big of a deal and something you're going to forget about. And by this time you don't even, it's not sticking on the top of your mind.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not afraid to kill things. Like, if you're not killing things, you're not trying hard enough.
Oh, I like that. Okay.
I mean, well, we've kind of backed off a little bit from really trying to push our zone. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're not trying to buy zone 4 or zone 5 fruit trees anymore. We gave up on that because planting fruit trees is a pretty big hassle. So all of the fruit trees we buy now are all solidly zone 3.
Okay. Oh, that's good advice.
Yeah, and they're not early bloomers because that's what gets our fruit, the blossoms, when the blossoms bloom early and then we get one of those spring hard frost, and then all the blossoms die and we don't get any fruit that year.
I like that advice, and that's good to know that even that there are trees out there to look for that aren't early bloomers, and to think about that when you're looking at a fruit tree.
Yeah. And
how about something that's easy to
I was gonna say, and vines too. Like we've tried lots of fruit, like the fruiting kiwi and mulberry, and there's a lot of plants out there that are technically in our zone because they do the zone based on the winter lows, but that because of our late spring frosts, they just don't make it.
Okay, cool. That's good advice. All right. How about something you find easy to grow and generally successful every time?
Generally successful. I don't know about easy to grow, but generally successful. I really like growing squash. We don't really sell our squash. I just grow it because it's generally successful. And something about those huge plants and the huge leaves and the huge squash really feels successful. You know, you get this 15-pound Blue Hubbard squash and you feel like you did something right.
I like that. I love looking under the squash plants, like, and taking my camera down there, and I always imagine little fairies and little people living there. And I'm going to make a book one of these days about something growing in the squash plants or the... we don't usually grow pumpkins because that's something we've struggled with, but we definitely grow a lot of squash.
We grow pumpkins. We just grow the small pumpkins. We don't grow the big ones that they sell at the store. We grow like special varieties. We do most of our seed buying for the garden and the outdoor plants from Fedco. And then all the microgreens we do through Johnny's. But the Fedco is out of Maine, and they have a lot of cold hardy vegetables, and they write the length of season right on there. So we try generally not to choose anything less than 90 days unless we're willing to like plant it early and babysit it.
All right. Oh, that's great advice. I like that. Super tips. And I'll have to check them out. I don't think I've been to their website. Fedco, like FEDCO.
Yes. Yep.
F as in Frank?
F as in Frank, yep. And they're committed to, no GMO seed. They do a lot of organics. They do a lot of ecologically raised. They know their seed growers. And they actually have a seed labeling system. So each variety has a number, you know. And number one will be like organically grown by a small farmer. Number two will be like organically grown by a large conglomerate or whatever, you know, like they get really specific with who it's been grown by. And so there are a couple numbers that we generally avoid, but like 5 and 6, I think those are like grown by a company known to be involved with genetic modification or, you know, like the seed itself is not genetically modified, but the company that grows it have been involved in that. So then we just boycott that.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks.
So you know where your seed's coming.
Just on Monday, my episode on Monday, we talked about that movie GMO OMG.
Yeah.
I think that was Monday's episode or Thursday's episode. Last week it showed in Eureka. So maybe it was last Thursday's episode. So yeah, people will like that because it seemed like it got a lot of downloads. And actually, the woman I had who came on and talked about it, she talked about the March Against Monsanto last May, and she got a lot of downloads for that. So it seems like something listeners are interested in. So they'll probably want to check out that Fedco. And I think it's probably time where people are starting to think about seeds. Like, I don't know why most people order. I'm always the last one on it and, like, ending up having to go to, like, Home Depot or something.
Oh, gosh. 'Cause
I don't
get,
but this year, I think we're finally going to order on time.
Yeah.
So,
we usually put in our Fedco order at the beginning of January, and Fedco's really neat because if you get volume discounts, so if you can get a couple friends together and you guys order together and it ends up being more than $200, then you get a certain percentage off, and I don't remember off the top of my head what that percentage is, but the more you order, the more percentage you save, and they're already really affordable, much more affordable than Home Depot.
Ooh. I'll bet people's heads are just spinning thinking of good ideas there and like having like a little potluck with the seed catalogs out and everybody saying, let's order this and doing like a co-op seed order. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and it's you're going to want to save yourself at least a week to read the seed catalog itself because it's not glossy. It doesn't have like big pictures of the flowers that you're ordering. So you really have to read it and imagine the plant description. And then they're also use a lot of humor and they're a little bit political and it's really a fun catalog. It's very entertaining.
All right. I'm going to order it for Mike, like, as soon as I get off the phone. He'll love it. Cool. And that's something good to do in the winter, as the days are already, like, it seems like I'm waiting for the sun to come up for a long time. This morning I had an early morning phone call with somebody on the East Coast, and they're like, it's still dark there? And I was like, yeah. So.
Yes.
All right. Sarah, how about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in our climate?
In our climate?
Yeah, or your climate.
Well, I wouldn't want to steer anybody away from anything, because I feel like people are always, like, doing things that other people say can't be done. And I love that, you know, people here are growing sweet corn, which other people said couldn't be done. I mean, when we started planting fruit trees, and people would say, you can't grow fruit in Whitefish. You can't get a red tomato in Whitefish. And I just don't want to be the...
Really?
I don't want to be a naysayer. go for okay. it. Grow it. Try it.
Yeah.
Kill it.
I
had Who cares?
That girl, that girl Amelia I was telling you about with the duck in Billings grew sweet potatoes. And yesterday I interviewed a guy who's going to come out. His episode will come out next week, who's in Minnesota, like... an hour from Fargo, North Dakota. That was all I had to see on the map. I was like, how are you doing this? And he's growing all sorts of stuff. So when he gets his tomatoes to go red on, I was like, how do you do that? You're getting tomatoes to go red on the plants? So, yeah, okay, good advice.
I mean, we're humans. We have big brains, and we can use them for good, like figuring out how to get a red tomato. Right?
Cool. What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there anything you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
I pretty much like a lot of things about it. My kids, I'm like, okay, I'm going out to play. And one of them will turn to the other and say, when she says play, she means work. I like moving wheelbarrow loads of compost and straw and hay, and I like it all. Opening leaf bags and all that stuff other people might dread. Mowing. I really enjoy mowing.
Me too. I like mowing too. All right. Well, then we'll just skip over what's your favorite activity, because is there one that you really like more than any of the others?
Well, I really, really love planting seeds, which is a good fit with the microgreens, because I get to do it twice a week for a long time. I think seeds are such a miracle. I mean, they're these tiny little balls, and then they just transform and jump out of the ground and become huge, beautiful plants if you let them. We don't let them. We chop them off, but...
Oh, that's interesting. Because, like, I hadn't thought about that when you were first talking about it. Because, like, lettuce seeds are one of my least favorites to plant because they are so tiny. But you don't find that a challenge?
I think it's amazing. I think the transformation that it goes through just with a little water is just incredible.
True. Have you seen that movie, GMO OMG?
No, I haven't
because
seen it yet.
The little boy in it is just like you. Oh, you should check it out. Because that's where the father's whole story is. Like, he has this kid, and when the kid's three, his, like, favorite thing in the world is to collect seeds. And the little kid, you know, is going to be a farmer someday. And so he kind of really starts the dad on this journey. And their whole family goes on this journey to discover what's a GMO and, you know, what's going on. And he talks to all these farmers around the country and eventually goes to Monsanto, to the offices, which is an interesting thing there. And but yeah, it really all starts with his little son's love of seeds.
That's great.
So yeah, check it out.
I will.
All right. Tell us about the best crop you ever grew. Was there one year that things were just so prolific you couldn't give it all away?
Well, every spring we start way too many tomatoes. Those seeds are just so tempting. And we have friends that collect and, you know, save seeds. So they just give us, like, Ziploc baggies full of tomato seeds. So we start just a ridiculous number of tomatoes. And this year, we actually grew lots of red tomatoes in Whitefish because it was just an early warm spring, which turned into a hot summer, which now has been a beautiful warm fall. So we grew a lot of tomatoes and peppers and things that generally are hit and miss with our climate. But even though the tomatoes were very successful, my most successful crop for sure is our kids. I mean, this is such a special time for us to nurture our little people. And we might someday be better farmers than we are now. But right now, the most important thing for us is to nurture and raise our little crop of children that we have going.
Aww, that's super sweet. I like that. They're lucky to have you, too.
Aw, thank you.
And what a great attitude. Okay, so I just have to quickly ask. So, like, we had a pretty early freeze, even though it's been a warm summer. Did you cover your tomatoes or something? Like, how'd you get them to turn red? Because ours definitely didn't turn red on our vines, only our cherry tomatoes.
We have a couple little greenhouses. We have one small greenhouse, and then we have a pretty good-sized high tunnel. And so they were in the high tunnel. Uh-huh. Also, in our garden, we did have that same early freeze, but we had our garden kind of turned into a jungle this summer, and it was full of sunflowers and kale, and I think they just kind of formed a protective canopy over the tomatoes and kept the frost off of them long enough for them to ripen.
Wow, excellent. Okay, and then the other question I was just thinking is, if you grow a ton of red tomato, do you sell tomato plants in the spring? Because to me, it always seems hard to find, like, organic stars.
Oh, really?
I guess I don't really shop in Whitefish very often. But
yeah, maybe that's where the difference is. Yeah. We took a bunch of tomatoes to markets, you know, for maybe 4 or 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. But we didn't sell a ton of tomatoes. And then once we started getting the red tomatoes this summer, then we boxed them up and took them to the health food store and restaurants to help us get rid of the bounty. And we've been eating tomato soup like every day for weeks now.
Do you have a good recipe for homemade tomato soup?
No, I'm not a great cook. Truthfully, we put a bunch of tomatoes in the blender with some, you know, basil or garlic or whatever else we have. And then we put it in the pot and maybe put some spicy peppers if Wesley's not around. Or I'll put cream in there if we're in a cream mood. And we eat pretty simply, I guess.
I like to put rice in my tomato soup sometimes, too.
Yeah.
Tomato rice soup. Creamy tomato rice soup.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds delicious.
What's the best garden? Yeah. What's the best gardening advice you ever received? The best gardening advice you have ever received?
My friend Pam Gerwe told me, I was calling her saying, hey, do you have any little scraps of wire laying around? I'm going to put some little fences around my fruit trees. The deer keep eating them. And she said, Sarah, knowing how much you like to garden, you should just fence your whole property. And at the time when she said that, I was, oh, no way, that's going to be way too expensive. That's ridiculous. And then a year and a half later, we fenced the whole property because, of course, she was right. And the deer, my little hoops were not keeping the deer off the apple trees. So we fenced the whole property, and it was the best investment so far. Because we would not have any apple trees or flowers or asparagus. You know, the deer pressure is just too much.
Yeah, we kind of struggled with that. We had little beds with little teepee wire things, and then we built more beds with smaller space. And then Mike eventually fenced off, I think, like 260 feet of fence, and now he has the mini farm, and we have 6-foot-high deer fence all over.
I would also
The deer and Whitefish have their own personalities besides.
Yeah, they seem like uber deer. I don't know. We put up the black mesh deer fencing at first, you know, the black plastic, the invisible fence. Mm-hmm. Oh, and they would just punch right through it. It did not slow them down that much. So now on one side of our property, we have what I call like Franken fence, because it's like zip tied a big scar, and then there's like a patch of like woven wire over it, and you know, it's not beautiful. So I would recommend even investing a little bit more and getting the wire, the 10-foot wire game fence, which is what we're going to end up with all the way around.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't think ours is 10 foot tall. I think it's 6 foot tall, but it seems to work. I'll have to check with Mike. But the deer and whitefish, I swear they follow the crosswalks. I've seen those deer do some strange things.
they walk online
in a file. They're just, they have their own little, you guys got your own little set of deer down there. I don't know what they're doing.
Oh, they're everywhere. Right.
Sarah, have you ever entered a fair?
No, my daughter has with 4-H. We raise rabbits.
Okay.
And so she was in the fair last year, which was a very fun experience.
Okay.
It's my favorite thing to walk through the expo building and look at all the vegetables, but I've never gotten around to entering.
That's okay. Yeah, it's fun to go see the other things. My thing that I just have a hard time with the fair is that you're taking your prize-winning best vegetables, and then they sit there and they sit out for 3 days. Like, we had to have ours there on Thursday night this time, and so then they sat out all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and by the time you go pick them up, there's your bestest fruit, but it's okay.
Your bestest wilted zucchini.
Right. Yes. And our prize-winning eggplants this year. So,
oh, great.
But we ended up with lots of eggplants, so it didn't really matter. Usually we don't have as many, but this year, Mike, I don't know, we just ended up with an abundance of eggplant. So, yeah, it was fun. Okay, what's your favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
John. Oh, that sounds bad, calling my husband a tool, but he's not a tool. He is the one thing that if I had to move, I would take with me. Other than that...
I think that's so sweet.
The stirrup hoe is super useful, but nothing beats a good shovel. Unless it's a good pitchfork. I don't know. I like all three of those quite a bit. I'm not a garden gloves wearer.
Yep.
Definitely would leave the gloves behind.
Nope, they'd be going with me. I thought you were going to say, so when I first came up with this question, my very first reaction was a shovel, for sure. But then I decided it was my wheelbarrow.
Mm.
I don't want to live without a wheelbarrow again. We got a flat in ours 1 year, and they couldn't fix it, and I couldn't afford to buy a new one, and I never want to have to deal without a wheelbarrow again. And I just figured a shovel, you know, I could probably, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, some things you definitely need a shovel for, but I just figured I could figure out with a stick or something. If I had to, you know, if I was on a deserted island, plus a shovel doesn't cost as much to replace as a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, I think I could, like, put it on something and drag it, though. I think I could overcome the wheelbarrow.
Oh, that's true. That's
true. But the shovel.
Yeah.
The newest tool to me is the hula hoe, though. I found, or the stirrup hoe. I found that at the thrift store last winter. And so I got to use, or maybe 2 winters ago, and I got to use it, and it just was really fun. And so it was like the new toy. That's why it made it on the list.
That's actually, I'm pretty sure that's what that guy yesterday recommended. So a couple of people have said that that's their favorite tool. Yeah, I think for sure a shovel. It would be very hard to grow a garden without a good shovel. Okay, so Sarah, here's my biggest question. I asked it a lot in the spring, and then I kind of cut it out during the summer, and I'm putting it right back in there because I'm in the middle of it. Eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Like, what do you do when you just have everything all come on at the same time? You got any tips?
Well, we do have an extra freezer. So a lot of things, I figure out how to freeze them, whether that's grating them and freezing them, or like even with eggs, you can crack them into a mason jar and beat them and then freeze them. Like zucchini and all that, I grate and then freeze it raw, and then you can add it to soups or crock pots or whatever. Fruit, mm-hmm. I make apple butter and pear, I'm sorry, plum spread, or I don't know what you call it. Then tomatoes, I puree them and then put them in the, you know, just yogurt containers in the freezer. And we freeze a ton of raspberries. We make all our basil into pesto and freeze that. So I'm just big on freezing and just eating. We just, when it's in season, we eat a lot of it. And then when it's gone, hopefully we put some in the freezer.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Those are great ones. So yogurt containers, like the bigger, because I've been so frustrated lately. I'm like, why don't they put lids on yogurt containers anymore? What's with these stupid tinfoil lids?
Oh.
But you're probably thinking of like the bigger ones, right?
Yeah, we buy the big ones. Even sometimes like the really big ones. And those work really well for like the, you know, we make bone broth out of our chickens or ducks. And that works really well for the stock. Because it's kind of pot-sized, you can just let it defrost a little and dump it right into the pot, and it fills it up.
Man, great tips. Excellent. I think listeners are going to like that. All right. And then do you have any different secrets for preserving food, or is that kind of, that's kind of sums up all that, right?
Well, I would love to say that I dehydrate, and I can, and I do all these great things, but truthfully, I don't. I don't have a dehydrator. I would love to dehydrate some of our apples at some point, but we make a lot of our apples just into juice, and then we feed the pulp to the ducks, and they love it. And then, so yeah, I guess that's another way we juice it. The only thing I actually can is pickles. We had a successful pickle year because of the heat. So I think we did 75 jars of pickles, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
We had a lot of pickles.
It kind of feels like a Herculean effort in the summertime when we already have so much going on to just add canning to our list. So, it was a couple late nights, but I feel like that was it for our pickling capabilities.
I know you do a lot already. I'm amazed that you get all the stuff that you get done and you're raising kids at the same time. Okay. How about, got any special techniques for cooking any kind of weird or unusual foods, or weird or unusual techniques for cooking ordinary foods?
Well, I'm just going to tell you what we did this morning. This morning we harvested and butchered 22 ducks. And so they're quite old. Most of them were about 4 years old, which for a duck is getting up there. So they're not going to be like delicious roasting ducks. So we pulled all the meat off of them, and we're going to make duck sausage out of them.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. And we like to add vegetables to our sausage. So we're going to put some beet and some carrot and maybe a little squash in there. And then we just package it up ourselves and freeze it. And
really?
Delicious.
All right. That sounds way too ambitious for me. Okay. What's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
Well, we cook a lot from the garden. I am not a recipe kind of cook. I am more of like a, what do we have? Let's put it all together kind of cook. So we eat a lot of venison. We eat, a lot of, doesn't have a name what we make. You know, it's sautéed vegetables with a steak or ground meat or whatever. So that would be my answer to your question is, no, I don't have a favorite recipe. It's different every time. and I just feel like we eat really well. And you can't really go wrong when you have super fresh, super high quality ingredients. They don't even need that much seasoning. You know, you put a tiny bit of salt in there and you're good.
Mm-hmm. I have no choice for that. I like to eat things. I don't even put butter like on most vegetables.
Oh, no.
Corn or potatoes or anything. Yeah. I just like salt and pepper.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite internet resource? Someplace you go on the internet to learn things or?
I'm not a very skilled computer person. I do use the internet. I think there's a group on Facebook that you're part of too, I believe. The Flower Farmers group. Mm-hmm. I learn a lot from them.
They are great, aren't they?
Yeah, I learn a lot from them. Mm-hmm. Floret Flowers I find really inspiring.
In Washington?
Yep.
Oh, wow. You know, my friend, Dacia, she has this business where she makes homemade aprons and homemade soaps, and they just ordered a whole bunch of her aprons.
Oh, that's great.
Or I wouldn't even know who they are. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Their website is just gorgeous, yeah. Isn't it? So, yeah.
Yeah. I try not to spend a ton of time on the internet. It's kind of a time suck.
I don't know how you would have any time to get on the internet. Yeah. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine?
I aspire to read a lot. I do read a lot more in the winter. And let me tell you what is on my nightstand right now. Resilient Agriculture by Laura Langnick, she spoke at the Aero Conference, the Johnny's Seed Catalog. The Resilient Gardener by Carol Depp, which a friend just loaned to me. And then Cut Flowers, an older bootstrap guide. Flowers for Sale by Lee Sturdivant. But I really love Joel Salatin. I've read all his books and I'm really inspired by him. And I really enjoy reading. Yeah, so I've kind of consumed most gardening books at the library. Market Gardening is a good one by Lee. Oh, I'm not going to remember his last name. Andy Lee. That was it. Had it backwards. I also like The Joy of Gardening. Awesome. And How to Grow More Vegetables and The Gardener's Guide to Better Soil. I like books a lot. The Fedco catalog.
Me too. Awesome. Well, I can't wait to get that one. Cool. Awesome. Okay. I think that'll keep our list. I think people are going to be like you and going to want to read this winter. All right. So do you have any business advice for listeners if they want to sell extra produce or get started in the industry?
Yeah. Well, that Backyard Market Gardening book by Andy Lee is really... His tone in it is really positive and it's really encouraging. And I think if people read that, they'll be inspired to start with whatever they have. And that would be my advice, is just start and start learning and start trying and start making mistakes and learning from those. And I think it was in that book, or it was Joel Salatin, but somebody said, you don't know how to take care of 20 acres until you know how to take care of 1 acre. So don't let not having a ton of land stop you from doing what you want to do.
That's perfect. Oh, I really like that. Okay, ready for my final question? It's kind of a doozy.
Okay.
It goes like this. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, Sarah, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or globally?
Well, I'm just going to talk to you about something that's really close to my heart, and I think it could make the world a better place, but we are part of a care farming program that's here in the Flathead Valley, started by Martin Fisher, And so we have three clients that come to our farm once a week, and they are, you know, disabled in some way, whether it's a traumatic brain injury or, you know, a disability, or, you know, some seniors come, and it gets all these folks out of the house, and they feel capable, and they feel part of something that's, you know, it's really empowering for them. They're learning about food systems, they're learning about nature, they're learning skills that then they could maybe someday apply to a job, and that would be something that I would encourage people. It's through A-Plus Healthcare, would encourage people to, like, donate to it or donate their time. They need drivers. They need people to help these folks that can't get out of their houses to get them to the farms. They do a Spartan race for these folks, and it's really fun. It's at Centennial Farm in Kalispell. Just getting the people that weren't born as lucky as we are, getting them in touch with nature and in touch with food and helping them make better life choices.
Oh, I like that. All right. I have no idea that goes on or never heard of it. So I think our listeners are going to like that, and they'll maybe look for something like that in their area.
Yeah. Actually, truthfully, it's the only one in America. They've done it in Europe. They've done it in the Netherlands. And now I think Switzerland, Martin has started a care farm program, but we are, like, so proud to be part of the program because it's the only one that is in the United States right now.
Oh.
It's pretty amazing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Well, maybe they'll find out about starting their own. Well, I always tell people, you always hear here to hear first. Remember, you're here to hear first from Montana.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, we're groundbreakers. So, you know, first woman elected to Congress from Missoula. Back in 1916, Jeanette Rankin.
Yep. So, someone's got to do it first.
Awesome. Okay, cool. And Arrow, I think, is one of the only, alternative energy resource organizations in the nation. You know, we have that here. That's linking sustainable agriculture and people and different things. I think that's going to expand nationally eventually. And who else was telling me about some other program? I talked to Neva from the Environmental Studies program on Monday. That's whose episode came out on Monday. And she was talking about a woman who started a thing that went nationally. I can't remember what it was. But there was a woman down there that started some kind of community farming program in Missoula.
Neat.
And then, of course, we have Denise Juno, Superintendent of Education, who started Graduation Matters. That's definitely spreading to increase graduation rates all around the United States, which is another one of my big passions.
Oh, that's great.
Anyway, do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I was probably supposed to prepare that ahead of time, wasn't I?
No. No. And I was thinking that what you said about the, if you don't know how to care for 20 acres.
Yeah. And that's not a direct quote.
That's
kind of a summary, but that is really true.
But you have shared so much valuable information with us today. Thank you so much for taking some time to teach listeners what you know and share about your family and your story and the different things. And I think you're going to really inspire people to grow some stuff. Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you at all, to go to your Facebook page?
Page is a great way to get a hold of us. And also, we are working on a website. I don't think it's up yet. A friend of ours is doing that for us. Okay. So it will be up in November, and it's going to be buggyroadfarm.com.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.